colleagues, I'd like to turn the floor open to your comments, questions, and suggestions. So please feel free to come forward and use the microphones. And for the purpose of the recording of the video, which we will post on the website, please state your name and also your organization. Before I entertain the questions, though, could you please fill out the questionnaire, the survey forms, the yellow forms that are on your sheet. We certainly want to have your feedback, and this helps us to improve the conferences next year, future years. So I'll turn the floor open. Yes, please, sir.
Sam Goldberg. An almost universal complaint by young people everywhere is that too frequently their elders, parents, teachers, politicians, don't practice that which they preach. And so I wonder if the panel, for illustrative purposes only, could perhaps indicate what outreach programs their employers have at their local level, because we all live and work in communities that have significant number of hungry, malnourished people. What do their employers do at their own local level in which they're located?
Yes, Dino, please.
At AVRDC's regional African office in Arusha, we have a scheme in which unemployed young men and women are allocated small plots of land opposite our institution, and they are taught and encouraged to grow vegetables for sale and distribution, and hopefully to become a career for them.
Thank you. Please.
My name is Margaret Berry. I'm a pediatrician who works for the McGill Northern and Native Child Health Program, and I'm actually the pediatrician for Nunavik for the Hudson Bay Coast. We heard from the Center for Indigenous Peoples Nutrition and Environment that food security is a big problem in the Canadian Arctic, although stunting isn't. And certainly in Nunavik, this is what we see. Children who aren't stunted or very few are stunted, and wasting is almost non-existent. Clinically, it seems that a lot of this is because of the persistence of traditional custom that's still intact. The hunters' associations allocate the caribou and the other things to the families that have the most children and that are the poorest. Aboriginal side as well. The ground where we stand was once Iroquois land, where the Iroquois were the most sophisticated agriculturalists in Canada. They were part of the American culture that gifted the world with the Three Sisters, with maize and other important food products. And as we all know, in Canada, the Indigenous people are now the poorest nourished that we have. So that my question for anyone that would like to talk about it, we've heard a lot about the importance of assisting disadvantaged communities with food production. And I wondered if people know about initiatives that support the Indigenous people of Canada to produce food.
Okay, I'll let the panel respond, but Harriet, we'll also ask you to make a response to that question, please, after the panel. So anybody from the panel wish to speak? No? So Harriet, would you like to? Or Tim's at the microphone, too, but...
Thank you for volunteering.
So the question is, what initiatives exist to help Indigenous peoples in Canada provide their own food resources?
Yes.
Is that the question?
Yes, if there are any. Maybe that there are not.
They're mostly internally driven. There is a lot of government support for maximizing traditional food resources, but providing access to those food resources is very low-key in the government level. Is that enough?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harriet. Tim, please.
No,
oh, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Lana McGuire, and I'm a student at UBC. So I just wanted to take the opportunity just to thank you so much for organizing this conference and having all of these distinguished speakers, and just to also take you up on your invitation to share some observations that I've had throughout the conference. The expression, this knowledge being stored up in silos has come up a couple of times, both here and back at UBC where we've discussed it. And I think that it's interesting that kind of the dichotomy between discussing a starving world and knowledge that's being stored in silos. And as a student who's observing this from a perspective of one who's fairly new in this field, I just really believe that as all of you who have so much knowledge and experience and expertise are able to share that, and everyone's coming from a different paradigm and a different experience, but to be able to look at the issues that are at hand and to share the knowledge as we've been doing this week, that's a great source of hope for actually, as if that knowledge is going to transfer into food for the people that are hungry and to be able to feed them, that just to encourage you that you've got something really awesome and to thank you for the heritage that you've left for the students that are going to be coming up and working in this field to come. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi.
Please.
Hi, Carolina Monardas, PhD student at Université de Montréal. So I would like to comment. Thank you first for the presentation. Each presentation, I think, complemented the other in a very interesting way. And what I would like to talk about was, I think it's Eugene's preoccupations with the leadership role of the Institute. Eh? And I think I was wondering if what was the place that was given to, I mean, human rights is fundamental in, I guess, in this Institute. But I was thinking to go further than just the right to food. I was thinking about the right to health for health workers, like working with pesticides. And I was thinking, too, about IP. I mean, you cannot think about IP if you don't think about human rights. If you ask, I know that you mentioned that we need patents, researchers need patents, but patents can also have detrimental effects on population. And we know that now that the Rio Convention protects indigenous population and their knowledge. So all these things have to be taken into account. So I was wondering about the mission of the Institute regarding to human rights, if you can explain more about that.
Well, it's a very good question. You know, we've only just launched the Institute. I can't say that we have an immediate work agenda with respect to human rights, except, as you will have remarked, the Dean of Law, Daniel Jutra, did express a very clear interest. He has always, and his predecessor, Nicolas Cassira, who is now a judge in the Quebec court, have both expressed a very strong interest and desire for the Faculty of Law to be an integral part of the Institute. And Daniel Jutra has been appointed a member of the board of the Institute, and we will be looking to him and his colleagues in the Faculty of Law to help us to develop that research agenda. But to tell you what it is today, I can't. I'm sorry. Tim?
Yes, Tim Johns from McGill University. And sitting here, it's my perception that both in the content and in the discussions that we have, there's a lack of really the position or the perspective of social scientists' participation in this particular conference. And I think the words of David Navarro on Tuesday night, he was talking about the human face, but he very specifically talked about social dimensions and the need for greater focus on that within attention to food security. I mean, I think about a couple of key elements I think have come out in this meeting of the important elements. One is the recognition of the complexity, the multi-sectoral nature of the problems, and the reality that people do act in silos. And that is a social issue. It's us and how we engage with each other. In terms of what we think we're talking about in relation to impact on food security of nations, of households, of individuals, the fact there are certainly multiple factors in that, of which economic is very important, but the social cultural element is extremely important when you're talking about how people adopt technology, whether it's advanced technology, where it's the simplest technology at the household level that allow that to be sustainable over the long term, or how people well decide or what determines whether they engage in markets and are willing to do that? What causes people to withdraw with that? I think we need a much more reflective and self-conscious attention to the perspectives of social science.
Thank you very much. I take that as a comment, and you don't require a response from the panel, do you? Unless somebody wishes to make a remark. Yes, Eugene?
Just to add to the fact that underlying the problems of integrating gender into our programs, the question of land tenure will always be a major social issue that has to be contended with, especially now in the context of what some people would like to call land grab. But I appreciate the fact that Mohammed yesterday did say that it might be as much water grab as land grab, and that is going to have a significant import for gender and for integration of women into our food security enterprise. So that component of our work should not be neglected, and so the social protection aspect of it is very important.
Thank you. Jeff?
Jeff Moore, McGill grad, and with the startup impact investing firm. I just wanted to see if the panel had any more comments on the potential of microcredit and microinsurance. We all saw an inspiring video with an example in a Ghanaian village yesterday. We've heard some comments about insurance. But just thinking about the role of MFIs at the householder level, the small-scale level, the cell phone, telephony, and the expansion of reach of microcredit and microinsurance into more rural communities, would anyone on the panel care to give any more comments on the potential role that you see in the expansion of access to credit and microinsurance to deal with global food security, at least at the household level?
Thank you. Marco?
Remember, in the model of technology, services, and access to markets, what you're talking about are financial services. That's in the service category, and that is totally necessary, and the world doesn't see enough of it. In particular, there is not enough rural credit for farmers, for production. There is not enough microfinance in rural areas for the purpose of agricultural production. Most microfinance is being devoted to SME, activity beyond primary production. And while that is important and helpful, I think that there is a lacuna there in terms of primary production and credit for it. The other thing, of course, that you're mentioning is insurance, and I believe I talked about that in the morning. Insurance is absolutely necessary as a means for farmers to be able to take risk to take the risk of investing. Now, there has been a lot of experience worldwide and trials with what we sometimes call conventional or traditional agricultural insurance. And the short answer, and that's a long story, but the short answer is that it has been basically abandoned both by governments as well as the profession of economists and so on that have been analyzing this, and there's a rich literature about it. And the reason is because the experiences that I'm talking about have led to huge losses that governments have had to absorb, premiums that would need to be charged in a system where you do loss adjustment at the field level are way higher than what farmers can afford, and so there is no incentive for the private in sector and the insurance industry to get into this. Now, having said this, the new thing is agricultural microinsurance. That is an area that is very much alive and well, but still in early stages. We have fewer breakthroughs in ag microinsurance than we have in other types of microinsurance, such as life and health. But there are a number of exciting leads out there, and one of which is something that I believe I've mentioned in the morning that our foundation has been able to develop, and that we can talk offline about it after this session.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Doug, please.
Douglas Headley. We've heard a lot about public-private partnerships. This is not the first conference they've come up at. This has been around for 10 years or 15 years, and the recognition that they have to take place. I think we also have to understand the reluctance of public sector to approach private sector, as well as the reluctance of the private sector to approach the public sector. To suggest it is distrust may be going too far, in many cases not. I think somehow we have to do the work to understand how that connection has to come together. I think there's a lot of work here to be done. It is not just a matter of calling for them. It is a matter of trying to understand them and plan them well enough that you build the trust on both sides. Without that trust, they're not going to happen. And you're going to find donors reluctant, and you're going to find the large companies that can make a huge difference reluctant to join them. The other point I'd make in listening to the panel this afternoon and even in Chanda's remarks, if we're going to go toward public-private partnerships, which I think are absolutely necessary, it is more than public science research that are eventually transferred and mated with private sector research. It is not just about technology transfer. It is also about bringing in both public and private systems in healthcare, not only remediation, but the overall community health and resistance to pests and diseases, because that is eating away at the calorie sufficiency that we already have. You need to add that with the local infrastructure. The private sector cannot create a market when the infrastructure for the movement of goods, services, and inputs is not there. Somehow you're going to have to bring that into the equation to be able to have those successful partnerships. There's lots of experience in that. Go and look at the country of the Congo, and you understand why fertilizer is 8 to 10 times world price by the time you get 150 or 200 miles from the sea. Look at what Mexico has done in their program in bringing infrastructure. You can price corn in a community at very nearly the same levels as you can in central markets. That was a change over a 20-year period, which was massive in terms of the change in Mexico. So I think it's a very broad topic that we need to look at. There's many more than two partners here, and there are many more disciplines. My observation over a long period of time is that there is no non-trivial problem that can be solved by a single discipline, a single donor, or a single department of government. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Point well taken, and you can see why Doug is the fearless leader of the deans of agriculture. He always points us. He's got the compass to point us in the right direction. So, Jean, you wanted to make a comment.
Just to follow up on Doug's intervention and where, you know, he was pointing towards to the fear of the public sector to get engaged with the private sector, but I have the opposite anecdote to bring to the table. The Canadian International Food Security Research Fund is open to private sector. Kevin, I'm looking at you at the back. We received 270 applications. How many were coming from the private sector?
One or two.
One or two. And we made a purpose to target the private sector. We have representative private sector in our governance mechanism. So there's something to look into. I'm saying that, you know, I'm with you, and it's on both ways, I think, to find better articulation probably on what is exactly the topic that needs to be investigated, if it's research, and how we can do it better.
Other comments? Dr. Gopalakrishnan.
Just on the same issue, we did have a lot of problems in India on this PPP, and we tried to add another P, which represents people, public, private, people participation, and it was making some wonderful impact. There was a general mistrust when the private sector was trying to enter from several groups, but the moment some of the representatives of the people also joined, though not a very, will-wise, they were strong partners, but the real players were the public and the private sector. And that way, the four pillars, PPPP, made wonders. While we are trying to look at it, perhaps some of these experiments in our parts, especially in the drinking water supply sector, it made some inroads. Private players could enter, and they could make some dent. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
A very short comment for the future. Firstly, I like to congratulate you with the new institute. As we have heard of these days, the issue is very complex. And I hope that this complexity is kept, both in your work, in the research, certainly in capacity building, so that we see that all those elements that have been discussed here over these 2 days are included. I think this is absolutely necessary, because food security, or global food security even, shouldn't be reserved for one type of profession, but the complexity of all the professions as far as one can go. So good luck, and thank you for a very nice and interesting 2 days.
Thank you. Just to follow up on your point, the provost, as you know, was at the opening ceremony on Tuesday night. I have to give him great credit, because as we discussed with him the establishment of the center and the governance and trying to get all the approvals through the university system, which, as you probably know, is a very complex governance mechanism to get through all the various committee structures. He was very adamant that it be a multidisciplinary center, that every single faculty at McGill have a role and have a say. And he and I consulted. He led the consultations with the other deans, and he was a tremendous supporter right through the system. He had a great vision for the Institute. He saw that the Institute was one of the few institutes that could bring all the faculties of McGill together in that multidisciplinary approach. And I'd have to say, and my colleagues at McGill know this, that on many occasions when both the principal and the provost speak, food security, food safety, and the work of the faculty in its breadth gets mentioned many times. And certainly they have put their support behind it, and not just their moral support, but they have also put financial support to help to launch it. So, I would have to say, if we stick to that message and that direction that has come from the highest levels in the university, we hope to achieve exactly what you have said, sir. So I thank you for that. I don't see any other people at the microphone. So at this point, then, I would like to formally bring our conference to a close. Once again, thank you for your participation. Thank you for the panel. And I wish you all a safe return to your respective homelands, and look forward to seeing you again next year. So, bon voyage. Thank you. Next year, so we're going to get some huge results from you.
And you can decide, but I think that the more was the second year than even the first year.